Opinions expressed in the following sponsored program are not necessarily those of KSCO Radio, its staff, management, or advertisers. If something is said with which you disagree, please call us during the program in order to help us balance comments.
Yes, Santa Cruz, welcome to the Cannabis Connection. I'm your host, Christopher Carr. Hope you had a beautiful week, and thank you for tuning in to Santa Cruz Cannabis Talk Radio. Very excited for the show tonight. I give thanks for Aaron to coming back. He joined us last week, but we had two people on the line. Sometimes that's just how it goes. It's live radio. But tonight we're going to speak to the works, righteous works of Sonoma Hills Farm. Our guest this evening is Aaron Kiefer, the Vice President of Cultivation and Production. Prior to joining in February 2020, Aaron held a tenure as culinary gardener for the Thomas Keller Restaurant Group, which includes the famed 3-Michelin-star restaurant, the French Laundry in Napa, California. Kiefer's green thumb and passion for the land emerged as a young child in his grandfather's farm in upstate New York. In the restaurant world, Kiefer built a reputation as one of the most respected gardeners in the industry. From the life of the soil to pest management, microbial and fungal elements, to the weather, he understands that gardening does not exist in a vacuum. The finest ingredients are produced in harmony with nature and the elements that it brings. Furthermore, Kiefer cultivated legal and top-shelf medical cannabis flowers that sold at premium dispensaries like the Apothecarium, Grassroots, and Peace and Medicine, which is now Spark, and before 2018 under the passage under Proposition 215 guidelines. So that's the pre-Prop 64 era. Before developing his passion for culinary gardening, Kiefer honed his culinary skills under notable Bay Area chefs Michael Carrello and Julian Serrano, and subsequently became the executive chef at Marin Country Club, where he was later promoted as its food and beverage director. He is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. Very exciting to connect with someone, and I would love to discuss part of that synergy and the overlap of developing a palate and just overall excited. Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to talk about cannabis and food and what I think that the flavor is. I think what I think flavor is, both for food and growing vegetables and for cannabis.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, thanks for setting that. Yeah, it's really timely. I feel like there's a lot of these dinners happening and pairings and overall discussion around the developing of a palate. I think one thing in the point of sale or at these retail establishments is the deepening of the understanding of the terpene profiles and getting to a place of that sensory awareness of, like what you said, that the pure flavors. Where are you in the world right now?
I'm in Napa, California.
Wonderful. Excellent. And how is life at the farm? It's a busy time, I imagine.
Oh yeah, we're probably about 80% down with the harvest.
Nice. So that's great.
Five weeks of a grind so far.
Got it. So you started in September.
Yeah, we started in September with the first crop that came down. So we had about 16 varietals this year that we grew. And the first one to come down is Pink Jesus, which is one of our signature strains. She's super early. She's an old, kind of like lightning in the bottle strain that is an indoor queen and clone only. So it's kind of long in the tooth and really slams into flower once it goes into the ground. So finishes off very quickly. She finishes off around September 16th every year.
Wow, fantastic. That's a hard one to infer the lineage. What is Pink Jesus? Who are the parents?
Oh, there's Starfighter. There's Pinkberry. There's a couple unnamed as well. And the breeder for that, Sam Magruder, you know, he he worked with, you know, it was like a cross of a cross, and, you know, he came up with some seeds and blew them out. And then out of everything that came out, this was the special one.
Nice.
And he kept it. He kept it because of the color, and the high seems to be something that almost everybody loves. It's a very social high. It's very up. You know, I personally love the high. The plant itself has, you know, some. It's not what I would call one of the modern plants where it yields well and it's resistant to everything. It's kind of a little bit of a jump through a lot of hoops to grow it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, people really love it. And at the end of the day, when people talk what a great strain is, there's a lot of things for me of what makes a great strain. Yield, resistant to pest pressure and diseases, you know, has to test well. It has to grow well, you know, and be able to grow in the environment. But the fifth and most important thing is, of course, do the people like it? And if people love it, well, that's a good strain, even if all the other four aren't there.
Oh, well said. Well said. I loved how easy that flowed. And I concur. That's exciting. So this Pink Jesus, is this kind of an heirloom cultivar to your area, or what are the roots here?
Well,
is this? Yeah, I'm very curious. It's something I've never come across. I love learning.
No, it's we're actually the only ones with it, and it's out of
cool.
San Francisco.
Okay.
You know, back from Prop 215 days, and we're the only ones with that one. We have another signature strain called Cherry Cheesecake that we share with Gold Seal out of San Francisco. But other than that, we work with a lot of other kind of best-in-class genetics partners and Node Labs, a.k.a. Compound Genetics. We're very close to them. We do a lot of their gear. We ran some Humboldt Seed Company product this year. And we also had a lot of Purple City genetics, some of their fun cultivars. What else did we worked with BioVortex last year with some of his
nice.
Seeds. We're really happy with his stuff.
Jesse's a good friend. Yeah.
Oh, Jesse is a good breeder. I want to get my hands on some more of his stuff. You know, it's just really, you know, there's so many copycat strains out there right now, and it seems like gelato seems to be like a real big theme throughout the entire industry. So to have Jesse's products, you know, BioVortex products, it's not what everybody else has. So it's really exciting for me.
Yeah, those Black Dog. Yeah, all those all the dogs.
Black Dog, Holy Tonic. I think I had some of that. And then there was one of my favorites was Grape Grease Banana.
Wow, that's one I've never heard of. Yeah, how cool. Grape Grease Banana. And speak to your, what's your environment like, and what's the terroir of your farm, and just the conditions and any other, you know, key factors, because we'd love to learn about growing in the sun, growing full term, growing from seed, but, you know, things can really vary based on environmental pressures.
Oh, yeah, terroir is everything. Even though this is an annual and it's not a perennial like the grapevine,
sure, yes.
I do believe terroir is really, really important. We are about 9 miles from the ocean, so we are we get a little bit of marine kind of influence. But what is beautiful is we're high up enough. We're about 450 feet elevation that we don't have the fog sit right on us all the time.
Right, perfect. Yep.
So that's nice. So we're temperate. And the real feature is we're in the Petaluma Gap, which is the biggest feature is the wind. Every afternoon, the wind picks up. We might get 30 miles to sustain the wind every afternoon. And people are starting to call it the Turk Belt because of the wind. You know, the stress that happens from the wind pressure out there kind of whips that butt around. And it really kind of produces a little more terpenes and a little more oils as a kind of like a – just a stress factor.
A reaction, you know, to the stress of the wind pressure. Yeah, I imagine that even when, you know, little bugs are eating on the flowers, that produces, it's all these little stressors that produce these enhanced terpene profiles. They adapt. How interesting. Is that?
Absolutely. there's good stress and bad stress, and, sure. and the wind is a good stress. But we're really happy, first and foremost, with the soil out there. You know, outdoor cannabis was grown in pots or under a redwood tree or on the side of a hill. A lot of times it was created in soil that was created or built, right? And it really wasn't grown on what we would consider to be great farmland because of the prohibition on cannabis. And we're finally growing cannabis on what is great farmland. This is broken down limestone cap. It's what is also known as the Sebastopol Goldridge soil. Luther Burbank talked about this soil that goes through Sebastopol up through Petaluma and parts of Sonoma. And it's really amazing, broken down limestone cap, almost like sandy loam, really high in every nutrient except for calcium. So that's easily amended with oyster shell flour or lime. And that's the base of our soil. And then, of course, we cover crop every year and add nematodes and compost tea and all the things to the soil to kind of create a very living soil that will kind of, create some of the best cannabis that I've ever grown. That's for sure.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah. Can you take me to the roots of your, so obviously the culinary roots, maybe we can start there or your grandfather's farm. Actually, let's go back to your grandfather's farm, and the way you speak of soil and the way you speak of terroir, it's really important I would love to learn a little bit about the source of this green thumb of yours.
So, I mean, I grew up in upstate New York in the Finger Lakes region, and, it was country there when I was growing up. Now it's a little more, it's not urban, but there's more vineyards and, more tourism. It's a very beautiful part of the country 7 months out of the year. And then the rest of the year it's frozen tundra. So, wow. I kind of had all four seasons. it's chilly there in the winter. And that's why I'm here in California. I did my 20 winters.
Good for you. Yeah. you made it. You made it to the promised land.
yeah, absolutely. So I grew up there and, in a farming community, and I grew up, my one grandfather was a traditional farmer, soy and corn and wheat and rotation, tractor work. And my other grandfather, my mother's father was a engineer for the railroads, like a, not a choo-choo engineer, but a mechanical engineer for the railroads. And when he retired, he started farming and he had a berry farm. And so that was my first job when I was five, is picking off Japanese beetles from the raspberry plants and dropping them in a little cup of kerosene to kill them. So that, I would get, I think, half a penny per bug. And
how cool.
Japanese beetles were a new pest at the time. They had just come over from Asia. So they're kind of devastating. And so I would work long enough to, get a candy bar at that age. But later on, I was doing other farm work. And, by the time I was 13, 14, I was throwing hay bales and really kind of thought that I hit the lottery when I went and got my first job in a kitchen when I was 16. I was inside and they fed me. I thought I was doing great. So, that was the kind of the beginning of my culinary career is cooking in the kitchen when I was 16 and 17.
Wow.
And then my journey for that kind of, continued, and, I went to work. I went to Riddle, which is kind of turning champagne or sparkling wine bottles, that little quarter turn. I got a job at Wagner Vineyards riddling sparkling wine. And they also had a restaurant, and I had already had previous experience. So at age 19, I was cooking there. I kind of worked my way up over the next year to become the guy underneath the chef. And then they fired the chef, and I ran the kitchen for a while. And
wow.
They hired a new guy and fired him. I ran the kitchen for a while. And by the time they fired the third chef, I said, hey, I've been already doing the job. Why don't you just give me the job?
Yeah.
And, so at age 20, I was a chef, and we were doing 400 covers a day. And I thought I knew what I was doing. And then I had a really, really rough night where, you know, there was an event and there was a party with 40 different steaks cooked at different temperatures. And I kind of went down in flames and it was a really rough night. And at the end of the night, I said, you know, I'm not learning anything for myself. I need to go learn more from people who actually know what they're doing. So that's when I applied to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York, and I was accepted, and then I went off to learn how to be a chef and went to Culinary Institute of America. And when I graduated, pretty much everything that I loved and I was cooking with was coming from California.
Wow, interesting.
And so I said, well, let me check out what this place is like. I mean, you know, it was supposed to be just a stop on the way to go cook in Europe. And once I landed in California, I had my first job with Michael Chiarello up at Trevino up in Napa Valley up in St. Helena. And once I got to St. Helena and started to enjoy the Bay Area, I realized, oh, there's no better place than this. You can have four different professional sports teams. You can go skiing. You can go to the ocean. You can have wine. Like, you know.
Mountains meet the sea. Yeah, wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of wine, lots of farming, amazing cities. My favorite cities in the world, the Bay Area, specifically San Francisco, is quite a gem. I mean, every city's got its challenges, and we're in different times. But how cool, man! That's amazing.
That's how I ended up out here. Yeah.
Wow, and St. Helena too. That's like a very special place. Like we have a little roots reggae band, and one of our tours, we had a we all formed in college, and we had a student. Mother was married to the mayor of St. Helena, and we played all these events in St. Helena over the years. It's pretty fun connection. And then over years later, I realized, oh my gosh, we were in this world class culinary and vintner, you know, paradise, just jamming, just like, just not knowing, just so oblivious to, but it's so cool because, like you said, you know, California is this very special place. And when you said everything you loved cooking with came from California, or was kind of a big chunk, the lion's share was sourcing from here. Is that just the produce, or is that what did
mostly
you mean?
The produce.
Yeah. Okay, great.
You know, California produces 60-70% of all of our fresh produce and fruits and vegetables. And, you know, once you come out here, you realize why. It's just a better place to grow. A couple things that make it really special is the arid part of the year. So we're semi-arid. We have our wet season and then we have a dry season. The arid part of the season creates a situation where there's almost no clouds in the sky. Well, that means every bit of the light energy, all the lumens, make it to the leaf, and we're tempered enough; it's not too hot. As long as you have water, things grow really, really well here in California.
Yeah,
and the pest pressure is a lot less too.
Yeah, that
because we're semi-arid. Heat.
Yeah, arid. Yes. Wow. How cool.
And if you grow out in New York, like, you know, there's a lot of pests, there's a lot of bugs. You grow in and the humidity is kind of a killer too. Humidity brings on a lot of diseases.
Sure.
Whether it's cannabis or anything else.
Sure.
I've been to farms in Virginia, and I'm just, mildews. I've been to farms in Virginia. It's horrific. Like how many pests? You'll have 12 different pests on one row of vegetables. And, you know, out here in California, we're just, you know, in a semi-arid situation and a desert situation. There's just less life overall. So there's less bugs. There's less pest pressure. And things grow so well in that low humidity.
Yes, yes. It's something I've noticed too growing up in gold country. So I'm from the kind of the foothills near South Lake Tahoe, higher elevation, 3,500, but not too cold, it's not the Sacramento Valley, right? It's not crazy hot, but I can empathize with that arid. There is certainly a very distinct dry time and wet time. And things can get pretty hot, but then you have those temperature swings. You know, it'll swing down pretty low at night, especially when we come to this time of year or that Indian summer, September transition into fall. You see, you know, really dry, warm days. Amazing growth in the cannabis plants. But we also had a lot of vintners, a lot of grape growers in the Sierra Nevadas, and they do so well. It's such beautiful. It's really nice. There's really great. There's a lot of fruit growers where I'm from in Apple Hill, mm-hmm. obviously, but a lot of the apple orchards are being transformed to vineyards. I'm seeing a lot of people pivot to growing grapes from pears or apples, and of course, cannabis grows really well in that region. And then of course, yeah, we've had drought. California's had drought. But growing up as a kid, I definitely would experience beautiful, you know, we weren't far from Sierra Tahoe and Heavenly and Squaw Valley and getting to the mountains and going, you know, doing the snow sports and really experiencing that wet season, but savoring those warm and dry times. It's something that, yeah, I really love how you put that. And I love that. I love that observation. And I think, do you think long term, when we see the unraveling of the Schedule One and maybe a interstate commerce option, I know there's a lot of shifts happening, and little steps are pretty big victories on a federal level. Do you think California would, similar how we produce our produce, 60% of the fresh produce is coming out of here? Do you think when it comes to cannabis, it'll be a similar situation just because it's a better place to grow?
So I do believe that there will be protectionist policies in some states, just like there were after the prohibition of alcohol. You know, there's still dry counties to this day. So there
sure.
will be some
yeah.
states.
El Dorado County is pretty dry. Yeah, you're right.
And there will be some states that put protectionists, so you can't encroach into that market as much as others. But there will be others that allow interstate commerce. And, you know, when you talk about indoor growing, you can grow the same quality indoor anywhere as long as your facilities are up to snuff. You know, indoor growing is going to be more about, cost per kilowatt for electricity, as well as labor, and also, how good the tax situation is. And so access to cheap capital will also be important. So that's going to be how you win the game with indoor. But with outdoor, there's only a few places you can grow great outdoor cannabis. And, you know, it kind of mirrors where you can grow great grapevines. You know, it has to be semi-arid. It has to have a dry spell at the end of the season so that the cannabis is not moist at the end of the season when it's budding. And it has to be temperate. It can't be too hot. It can't be too cold. And I truly think that there's only a few places in this country where you can grow great cannabis, and luckily Northern California is one of those.
Yeah.
So, yes, I believe that, you know, the future there will be, you know, there'll be indoor cannabis, and I grew indoor for 20 years. I absolutely know a lot about it, and I do believe in it because we're going to need that 4 terms a year, you know. You need more production.
Sure.
But when it comes to quality cannabis, I think that the education of the consumer is not really where it needs to be yet, because there's a lot of people who say that indoor cannabis is the best product out there. But that's just not, in my opinion, as a guy with a palate and a connoisseur, I think that the best comes from living soil under the full sun, not even hoops. You're going to get the highest expression of the plant with the most terpenes, and you can even, you know, push the THC level a little higher indoors, but that's not the whole story when it comes to the high. So you can't replace great, great outdoor cannabis with any other product. And I think that Northern California is the premier place to grow that.
Amen. Well said, man. Yeah, you're so right. It's logical. Full sun, living soil, the right terroir, the right conditions. Yeah, I concur.
It's the highest expression of the plant. It's the
full potential.
You know, so if you think about like a nice vine ripe tomato, and we see them in every grocery store, they're round, they're perfectly red, they look so good, right? And then you have your heirloom tomato. Your heirloom tomato might have some nicks on it. It's a little misshapen. Well, which one would you eat if you were eating with your eyes? Probably the vine ripe. That's what the tomato should look like. But when you put them in your mouth, you understand which one is better immediately. And that heirloom tomato is going to be absolutely delicious. And for me, I believe flavor is nutrition. So if it tastes better, that means it is better for you. We co-evolved with these plants. When we put it in our mouth, it's absolutely delicious. It has more nutrition. It has more micronutrients. It has more sugars. It has everything that you want out of it. And I think that, indoor cannabis is very similar. You can grow some great indoor tomatoes, hothouse tomatoes, and they can be tasty and they can look perfect because you're controlling the environment. But when you're talking about the highest expression of cannabis, as a connoisseur, I believe that outdoor cannabis that's grown well is probably still going to be, the best cannabis out there. And it is in short supply because there's only a few places that can grow great cannabis, as well as there's only a few people actually growing it in living soil and doing it, the correct way. So I think that will be the luxury item of the future when you're talking about cannabis.
Yes, yes. Oh, I'm so excited to dive a little deeper here. One thing you said quickly as a person with a palate, when we think about developing our palate, what suggestions do you have? And this could go, cannabis is a flower. It's got all these amazing compounds and terpenoids and cannabinoids. But thinking about the expressions and furthering people's appreciation and one piece that really resonated with me is that the education is not quite where it could be. Obviously we have, it's a nascent space. We're coming out of prohibition. What are our next actions to elevate the appreciation of cannabis and to further inspire the public to develop their palate? Any ideas or thoughts or simple?
Yeah.
I love how you put things. It's so accessible and it's easy to comprehend the way you put things. I'd love to hear about developing a palate.
So I believe that developing a palate is a skill like anything else. It's a hard-earned skill. If you're a sommelier, you've developed that palate over years of tasting wine and tasting them against each other and really learning about it. And that's a very expensive education when you think about how much wine you need to drink over time to understand what great wine is. Cannabis food is the same thing. I mean, as a chef, I graduated from culinary school, and I would have to say it's 5 years deep of cooking, 50, 60, 70 hours a week before you really know what you're doing. And,
wow,
and
amazing.
That's expensive too,
Sure. It's a lot of food.
All this fine food.
Fine food.
A lot of food. It's a lot of expensive food.
A lot of ingredients.
So,
a lot of farmers. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it takes a lot to build a palate that is educated. It's very expensive. It's one of the most expensive things you can do. And cannabis is the same way. There's a lot of great connoisseurs out there who have spent a lot of time smoking a lot of different cannabises. But when you're talking about the education of the consumer, we're a little ways off because we're still talking about things like THC levels. And that's just one snapshot. That's just one story out of the whole narrative. That's just one voice out of the whole narrative. So I think that we don't really have what I would call a food critic out there yet for cannabis. We have people like and really true connoisseurs like Jimmy Devine and David Downs and their journalists and their connoisseurs, and they try to educate the public. But we don't have our Robert Parker of wine yet of cannabis, where he can easily explain and break down to the is being recommended looks a little, not as pretty as the other one. So I think that we need what we look to in restaurant critics or even chefs, and we haven't really developed that kind of public persona yet, somebody who can guide the public and say, okay, here's really what you're looking for. And so I'm hoping that we can get some voices out there to educate the public as to what is better, you know, because right now we have a lot of people who are entrenched maybe monetarily in their own interests telling you, oh, well, this is better. And we actually still have a debate over indoor versus outdoor versus mixed light. And, that's not really what we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about the practices of growing. And, you know, how it was grown and how it was treated during the life cycle.
Yeah, I think yes. And to the earlier piece of our conversation, I think sometimes is what you're growing. The genetics are a piece of that puzzle. Other things we spoke to, like terroir, and I also feel there's almost like to find the best genetics sometimes is tied to the cultural history of the cannabis community in that kind of legacy heirloom area, like a cultural terroir. It's something that I feel very strongly about, especially in Santa Cruz. It's such a unique place, but where you are in Northern California, going up into from Sonoma County and wine country into Mendocino, and the Emerald Triangle and Southern Humboldt, of course, and Trinity and these kind of higher northern – oh, well, and Southern Oregon too, like the state of Jefferson. There's this whole interesting zone of really kindred spirits and farmers that really are going deep into this regenerative conversation and these best practices and kind of closing loops on their farms and really getting – really getting serious about the genetics. That's one thing that I think is really important, and finding things that kind of appeal to the market. But like you mentioned with BioVortex, like it has elements, but it's completely unique. We're kind of satisfying some of the aesthetics of a market appeal or bag appeal or jar appeal, but then again, we're working with things that are completely, just unicorns and that public persona. I like what you said there. And are there other criteria or other things we should maybe think about and contemplate when we consider, like, I think is that public persona? Do you think the value is? Like, for their background, like, you mentioned Jimmy Devine. He's been on the show. He's great. I've met David Downs a few times, and they're journalists, though. They consume, right? They're writers. They're not quite growers. They're not quite – I mean, obviously, that's one piece of it, but one thing that you – what speaking to you, which is so – is so enriching, is, like, you have this palate. You have this appreciation that – the awareness to understand this is something that is earned, it's expensive, it takes time, it's almost humbling over time to realize that, you take all this and then you may not quite know. You know enough to know that you still have a ways to go. But then you're also cultivating and farming. And do you think that public persona should be a grower or should be a breeder or should be a dabbling in both or should be a writer? What does a criteria?
I mean, it has.
Or it has all to of be the above.
Who can all of the above. It has to be somebody who can communicate clearly. It has to be somebody who understands, the basics of cannabis and how to describe her. And it has to be somebody who can be, I guess, approachable enough that the public can understand what they're talking about. Because I sometimes, I've been a cannabis grower for quite some time, and as well as on the other side of it, the culinary side of it. So they're quite different cultures, and the cannabis side of it sometimes doesn't feel approachable by, the other day I was called a normie. And so that means I'm a little outside of maybe what the what you would call the cannabis culture.
Oh,
and I kind
wow.
of take that with a bit of pride. You know, I am a normie, but the normies are a huge, huge market, you know, and
yeah.
and that is really the market, the subset of,
yeah.
you know.
The market are the people that have yet to really develop the relationship with
yeah.
cannabis. Yeah, like that is the future, and that you were so right. You need to be approachable. You need to be able to connect with a broader audience.
Because it has to appeal, and it can't be scary. And I think that sometimes, like, you know, sometimes some of our true cannabis events or what the people, the true headies would call, like, oh, this is real cannabis, isn't approachable by the average person. So, you know, I think that we're still pretty far off on it. I mean, we're just coming out of prohibition. You know, there's a lot to be fleshed out. And you talked a little bit about genetics, and I agree. First and foremost, genetics are the only thing that's important. How you grow it is important. How you store it and how you cure it is just as important. But it all starts with the genetics. And we're so far away from where we need to be with genetics because, like, a lot of the seeds that pop, there's a lot of genetic variability, and we call them phenotypes. But that's the same as it is with every vegetable and every plant. But when I order lipstick peppers and I grow those out, I will have all the plants looking almost the same.
I know. The product will taste the same.
And that's seed stable. And we aren't there yet with cannabis.
We are not.
Breeding. We
no.
have seed stable. And that takes a long time to get to. 15 to 20 years of one person kind of concentrating on it, like 16 cycles. Or when it's federally legal, we're going to have these land-grant colleges and these large ag universities applying their knowledge and their brain power
to these. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And that's when we really will make leaps and bounds. So.
Well, but don't you?
Know, we've really done a lot during prohibition, but
yes, we have.
Change completely soon.
It's so funny too. Right before, I mean, I'm harvesting as well. I have this humble mm-hmm. acre field in South County, Corralitos, and listening to a researcher. There's this Tad Hussey has a little podcast. It's a science and cultivation podcast, and he's speaking. I forget her name, but. In short, she was speaking to the names. She did the research and kind of came to the conclusion that the names really don't mean much, right? You can get three cookies from a dispensary, and you do the genomics and, you know, analyze what's there. And it's, you know, one is maybe closer to Jack Hare than actual cookie genetics, but it's labeled cookies at the shop. And her advice was, like, you know, if you find something medicinally that works for you, you know, go back and try the same dispensary, same brand, same name. But if you go to a different dispensary and buy different farms, cookies, you don't expect the same result. Like, don't, you know, it's not about the name. It's more about the farm and being as close as possible to that. And in many ways, I love what you said about the peppers. But don't you think there's some magic still in having, I don't know, I think there's a balancing
act. Yeah,
you know, because sometimes you find the unicorns in those rare F1 phenos. I think a lot of the hype market cultivars were like bag seed or just mm-hmm. one-off interesting things we're home of the haze here in Santa Cruz, home of the skunk. Sam the Skunk Man was from Watsonville and went to Europe after getting apprehended and made it out. And, you know, that started a lot of the Neville Schoenmaker and all these Dutch seed banks were working with Santa Cruz gear. And all he was trying to do was introduce the Afghani and stabilize some Colombian and, if, you know, make that flower time a little shorter. I mean, we all had very humble, simple goals. In the beginnings, in those old times, looking back, that's like 50 years now, but late 70s, early 80s. And but you find like the Blue Dreams and these things that kind of changed in the Prop 215 era. It changed the, you know, our first businesses that I was a part of were built on those cultivars, those varietals that were kind of rooted here. And I agree with you. Genetics are so important. And when you think about, you, like, I guess you already answered this question. Like, it will take the unraveling of some of these drug war policies to involve more of these educational institutions to do this hard work. But when you work with new genetics or a new breeder, what are you looking for, and what kind of, like, what inspired you to approach Purple City or BioVortex or, the cheesecake?
Truthfully, all of this is relationships, and that's what's so special about this business is, you know, we were all siloed, right? We were all in our own little hole, like making sure that we weren't caught by the authorities. And so, you know, the connectivity and the communication that we have now was really not there not too long ago. And we were all in our own little. I look at it like. Everybody was in their little pirate ship, right? And then their little group of pirates along with them, and we were trying to do the best that we could. But you definitely did not talk about it, because loose lips sink ships. And you know, only lately have we had this really true collaboration, because you almost had to be introduced or vouched for otherwise. In the old days, you couldn't really just talk openly about anything. So I think we're at the beginning stages of this sharing. And when we're talking about Purple City, you know, it's relationships. And we're talking about all these other companies, it's relationships. And you're trying to, you know, really, you know, make connections and see if you can connect with somebody who's in the business. And you both have like-minded pursuits, and you want to work together, and I really think that's what it's about. And, you know, I mean, what I look for in a strain, of course, is first and foremost, how healthy is the strain? Does it grow well with resistance to pests and diseases? Does it yield well and grow in a nice growth pattern? Does it test well? Are the numbers on it high enough to be viable in today's market? And then, you know, last but not least is, of course, you know, what is the high? And the high is so personal. Everybody has the key that fits their lock, right?
And, yes.
Some strains are loved by everybody, and then some strains have maybe half the people who smoke it are fans. So I think it has to be all of the things above for me to consider it to be a really, really great strain. The first, so this is the third season at Sonoma Hills Farm. The first year we grew 30 cultivars. The second year we grew 30 cultivars. Out of those 60 cultivars of the first 2 years, six ladies were invited back to this garden. So
wow.
This year we have, so I mean, they were the ones who hit all the you know, the needs. And so out of the 16 cultivars of this year, I would have to say we're probably going to add another two to the six that are on staples, you know. So we might have eight now that we would consider to grow year after year. And then hopefully we can over time work to a point where 80% of the garden is cultivars that we know are going to do well in our environment, with our practices, do well on the market and everything else, and then hopefully work with about a 20% new cultivar standing every year to try to catch something that's going to be really, you know, special.
I love that. I love that. I think that's important long term, is to get to this point where you have 80% of what you know. That was part of that conversation with this researcher that she was speaking to. Indoor growers, this is not my favorite cup of tea, even though I was a part of many indoor farms, and that was very much how I built my skill set. But they had a test group in Colorado, and a farm they were working with, and essentially the conditions were set, right? Controlled indoor environment. And it was not that they changed the environment for the cultivars, but they would select certain varietals that performed the best in their set conditions, and just ran those, right? Just like is actually a lack of, they just ran what worked best. Mm-hmm. And exactly to what you're speaking to. And I think in some ways that's, it's an interesting idea. It's really, it's better because sometimes you run with so much, there's so many temptations in the beginning of the germination time of year, spring, early spring, late winter.
No, I know.
Yeah, you just get so caught
you
up.
You always want to keep on adding.
Oh my gosh. It's so, you don't even realize you're doing it until you look at the trays and you're like, oh my gosh, this is way too much. This is way too much variety.
What am I going to do with all these?
What am I going to do with this? Is this really how it's going to be? And labeling, and even in the field right now, I'm searching for wooden stakes or like, what is this? This is obviously different from that. And we're on this row and, oh, it's so challenging. So I love what you're speaking to too, because I think what you grow at your farm might be different than what we grow in Corralitos. And that's going to be very different from the 80% that we grow in gold country in the Sierra Nevada foothills. And very cool. I think that's a very special thing. And what an interesting variety to offer the world and California and that palette. And yeah, I think, yeah, that's fascinating. Of your staples, I love that it's so refined. You got down from 60 to 6, right? So you chose 10%. Mm-hmm. Flagship. Can you speak to some other flagship cultivars that you love and why you chose them? That's a pretty big cull.
Yeah, I mean, you know, truthfully, one that I loved last year, and we did it again this year, we actually ramped it up a little bit, is called Melonade. And that one was first bred by Midwest Best, and it came to us through Node. And it's Melonade number 8. It is really a great plant, a little less leafy than a lot. Quite a few bud sets on the plant. It grows well. A little pale. If I was running it, you know, indoors, I'd probably run it with a little higher nitrogen, fertility. I think it's just the leaf set, the way it looks. But man, last year we ended up with like 36% THC and 41% overall cannabinoids.
What?
And
wild numbers.
Super high.
Yeah.
Super high. And yeah, I don't really want to get into numbers right
now. Sure,
sure. The testing, I believe, has moved a little bit.
Agreed. Like 30 is now 25 moved. Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a little bit about testing. There is a state lab that's now going to be testing all the other labs. So I think that we're going to find a little more homogenized testing numbers pretty soon, because if there's more than a 10% variance, the state lab will then coach the lab. You know, which will eventually wind up with fines and whatnot. So I think we're going to have a little more.
This is good. Yeah.
This is good.
Yeah.
But yeah, this Melonade, the buds never really look like honkers. You know, they're not like huge, you know, something you'd hold your Coke can up to and take a picture of. But very, very dense. And then they dry down to a nice light green color. But the high is so strong. And I haven't smoked any of this year's cultivar. Last year's was very, very powerful for me. But a friend of mine just got into it today. And, she said, you know, the first hit, she knew it. And she got the tingles, you know, on the face. And, you know, she said that within 20 minutes, she was like on a rocket ship. So, that is a farm favorite. That's
wow. Melonade. How cool. Does it have those melon terps, or does it live up to the namesake?
Truthfully, when you're smoking it, you get it a little bit, but when you're talking about that initial burst of terp, it doesn't really have it. And when you test it, it's about 2.1% terps. But, like when you put your nose to it, it's very light to me. I mean, it has notes of gas, and it has notes of sweetness, it has notes of, but it's not like punch you in the nose terps, like a cultivar that I grew this year called Hella Jelly from Humboldt Seed Company. That one, it smelled like ripe cantaloupe when it was growing, and knock your head off with the terpenes. But yeah, Melonade doesn't really have it, but when you smoke it, it tastes well. It tastes great. It tests out at like 2% terps, and it's one of my favorite highs because you're really, really up. Yeah, really, really happy.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. How, in your experience too, with, we had Nat Pennington on. He's great. I love Humboldt Seed Co. What's it like working with these different groups? They're kind of, you mentioned Node, Compound, Humboldt Seed Co., BioVartex. These are really great groups, but kind of different worlds almost. I guess BioVartex.
Absolutely. I mean, Jesse is what I would call the old guard.
Yes.
He is true, humble, like, I don't know if you call him royalty. I would. But he's like in with everybody. He's about to premiere his movie. I'm going to give a plug to his movie this weekend up in Arcata. And, I'm trying to remember the name of it really quickly.
Tending the Garden. We did three shows.
Tending the Garden.
Yes.
So I'm super excited for that, you know. But he's truly walking the walk and talking the talk. He's been doing it right for a long time. But then you have somebody like Compound Genetics, and they've worked with Cookies, and they have a lot of indoor hype, and you know, they just came out with the Glitter Bomb, which I tested out in the garden this year, and they have Gastropop, which I tested out in the garden this year, and they have all these hype strains that are coming out all the time, and they're wonderful strains, they really are, but they're more for the usually for the indoor grow, and they're built for that modern look. That really chunky, frosty, you know, great look that you grow under LEDs or even HPS. And, it has that certain look that everybody's, calls the modern look. So very different from the BioVortex stuff. But I like variety personally. I mean, now that I've lived out here in California, in the Bay Area, there's few places that I could ever live just because of the food alone. I can get Indian one night and Thai the next night, Cambodian, which is different from Thai. I can get Japanese. I can get Italian. I can have everything I want in this area. And I love variety. I believe that's the spice of life. And I also believe that in the same thing when it comes to cannabis. Like, at the end of the year, we'll have what we call the library. So we'll have trimmed up nice jars of all the strains that we grow. And we'll have one set for press and kind of like VIP visitors. We'll have one set for the house weed.
AM 1340 KOMY, La Selva Beach, Watsonville, Santa Cruz. A service of ZBS.